Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CCXLVI, Laudatio Turia. In times of antiquity, along the Via Appia, stood the Laudatio Turia, a funerary inscription praising the life of an exceptional Roman woman. While we aren't sure of her actual identity, her husband was clearly fond of her and wanted everyone approaching Rome to know it. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
The Via Appia in Rome, or leading out of Rome, is the location for most of the funerary monuments that we know of from Rome, because technically everyone was meant to be buried outside the city. And this is the source of a lot of our funerary inscriptions from Rome because of that. Now, if I said to you, who has the longest funerary inscription of anybody from Rome? I know you know the answer, but what would be your guess if you didn't know the answer?
If I didn't know the answer, the res gestae.
Ah, yes, which is not outside of Rome.
You didn't say outside of Rome when you asked me that question, so I got you on a technicality.
You did. So Augustus's, I guess it's a funerary inscription, it's outside his mausoleum.
Mm.
But the longest one on the Via Appia is not any famous Roman politician, emperor, not even a bloke. It's the inscription of a Republican woman who is generally known as Turia, but we'll talk about whether she was Turia or not in a moment, because even though this is a very lengthy inscription on two separate slabs of stone, and it's fragmentary, so it was even longer, we don't know her name. Her name doesn't appear. That's one of the bits that's missing.
Mm.
So what we're talking about today is generally called the Laudatio Turiae, which means the praise, the funerary praise, the eulogy of Turia. This laudatio word is laudatio funebris, a funeral praise, is held to be a speech that was given at the funeral. Ancient historians think that it's unlikely that this speech was given at her funeral, maybe because of its length or the style of it. The Romans generally have a kind of loose relationship between what is said in public and what is then recorded. Mm. Think about some of Cicero's speeches. He didn't even give some of them, or he wrote them up and polished them a bit. So similarly here, this may or may not have been given at her funeral. It's in the voice of her husband, if it were to have been given then.
I absolutely would believe that this is something that would have been given at her funeral. It's very, as we'll see when we go through some of the text and the circumstances that it discusses, it's filled with emotion and it seems very evocative. I get the real impression that this husband loved and was very fond of his wife and will miss her greatly.
Well, I went and looked up, I just kind of did a Google search to see what people's responses to it are. And in places like Reddit, somebody's posted it there and the responses are, oh, he must have really loved his wife, or she's a worthy woman and it's a shame that he lost her. So it's certainly people feel that kind of connection with that. I will kind of undercut that a little bit as we go along, that some of it is kind of formulaic, the qualities that she's given. And also, I suspect there is a lot of hyperbole going on here. Sorry.
Okay. No. Okay, it'll be interesting to see how you deconstruct it then. Mm-hmm. So just some general info about this. These tablets, is tablet a good word for it? This inscription?
Yeah.
This
huge marble tablet.
2.5 meters tall and almost 1 meter wide. So this would have dominated the landscape of people who were traveling to Rome at the time.
Yeah.
So really would have stood out. The husband really wanted the wife to be known and seen. I've got the mental image of the monolith from 2001, A Space Odyssey, just towering over the skyline. Not quite, but
there are some pretty big monuments along the Via Appia. But in terms of the amount of, the verbiage, the verbal assault of this tombstone, then I think it probably, I mean, of course, there are some we've lost, but this probably wins at that battle.
But you got to think as well, 2 meters tall, 1 meter, two slabs of marble, expensive.
Oh, very.
Very expensive.
And very pristine, beautiful marble too.
Plus prime location.
Mm-hmm.
So wealth and fondness and regard all folded into one. But in the current context, it's not there. It was broken up
over the years because it's valuable marble. They found bits in cellars and propping up the foundations of buildings. So we've now got 7 fragments of it and a lot of reconstruction. We're missing the first 20 lines.
It's always the beginning we're missing, isn't it? I suppose that was at the top.
Yes.
Fell down first, potentially.
Yes. So we're missing the beginning of it. We're missing the first 20 lines or so, and we're missing other bits and pieces. But there's been a lot of reconstruction to try and put together what this would have said and the identity of the woman, which we'll also get to. And if you want to go and see this, Baths of Diocletian in Rome.
Yes. So the Museo Nazionale in Rome that is now housed in the Baths of Diocletian, well worth a visit anyway.
Mm-hmm. Take a dip, see the inscription.
You are not allowed to take a dip anymore. I notice in your notes you say it's the longest surviving personal inscription. I should have emphasized the word personal, and then you couldn't have got me with the raised guest star.
Ah, very good. you should read my notes. So when we say that this is an inscription to Turia,
yes,
what is the identity of that based on then, if it's not written in the inscription?
Turia is the wife of a man called Quintus Lucretius Vespillo, who's generally just called Lucretius when people talk about him. His father had been killed in the proscriptions of Sulla, and the events relating to his life are reported by Valerius Maximus, who's writing in the early imperial period in his Sayings and Deeds of Famous Romans, if I've remembered that, the name of that properly, Book 6, Chapter 7. And also in an earlier source in Appian in his Civil Wars in Book 4, Chapter 44. But even though there has been seen a connection between the kind of civil war woes of Lucretius and the events in the inscription we have, that's seen by many as coincidence. This is not an absolute attribution, and most ancient historians these days don't make that attribution, that equivalence.
Okay, so if Turia is not mentioned in the inscription and Lucretius isn't mentioned in the inscription, what we're left with doing is essentially detective work to try and figure out the identity of this. And historians have done this in the past by going, okay, this ancient historian has written about this happening. Whoever put this inscription up was clearly rich, and maybe we could find out who that was. Oh, look, some of these events seem like they're writing about the same thing.
Yeah.
And therefore, that is the identity of this person.
Yeah. And so Lucretius is a man who's affected by the prescriptions of the kind of next generation, couple of generations on of proscribers, and that is Octavian.
The Octavian and the Mark Antony and the Second Triumvirate.
Yeah, and Lepidus. Yep. And Lepidus, who does crop up here. This equivalence has been made, so it's reasonably similar in Appian in particular. And so this is kind of a mid-19th century equivalence, and Mommsen then kind of backs this up. Theodore Mommsen, who's, you know, big name German classicist in the 1860s. And that has sort of made this a reality in a way that may not be deserved because someone as big as Mommsen says it. Now, Lucretius was consul in 19 BCE, so his career came back. That's one of the points which means that some ancient historians later on started to pick this apart, because they don't see this as an inscription of somebody who was later consul. So, for example, Nicholas Horsfall in 1983 writes that Appian tells us about 50 stories of escape during the triumviral proscriptions.
He does. He does. He really goes into it, I remember. Mm.
And he says it's perfectly true that the laudator, so the person writing the inscription, the praiser, his adventures coincide most closely with those of Quintus Lucretius Vespillo. But the coincidence is by no means perfect, and the list of uncomfortable discrepancies is conveniently accessible. It is high time that the spectre of Vespillo was thoroughly exorcised. He's really not into this.
Yeah.
One of his main points is, this is from a 1983 article called Some Problems in the Laudatio Turiae. He points out that the writing doesn't seem to indicate the kind of education, even though it's somebody very wealthy, of somebody who would be consul. He says, modest education, deficient rhetorical training, absence of family pride, and total lack of political involvement. So he sees it as somebody who doesn't have the ambition, the kind of the
not worthy
the
of a
networks.
Consul. Yep, yep.
The Laudator appears an entirely improbable ex-consul. So there you go.
Well, I guess if you're an ex-consul, you'd have a certain amount of ability expectation that you'd be able to do a good speech.
Mm-hmm.
If this was delivered as a eulogy, that's public performance.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I can kind of see where he's coming from if you believe that what is written in the inscription is not worthy of a consul, ex-consul level.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard, isn't it? Because are we going to rate everybody alongside Cicero? Cicero is a consul, an ex-consul, who has so much talent as a writer and a maker of speeches, a rhetorician. Not everybody's at that level.
Yes.
I mean, we know now that our politicians don't always make the grade as great speech makers or charismatic people. They're not all going to be wonderful.
With that disclaimer in place then, we are going to call, for the sake of this podcast, this Lady Turia and her husband Lucretius.
Mm-hmm. But think of them all in quotation marks.
Yes. So page break, spacebar, spacebar. Let's go. Turia, what does this inscription tell us about Turia?
So she's definitely on the conservative side in these wars between, broadly speaking, the optimates, the senatorial side, and the populares, the more popular side in Rome. So in the late Republic, you'd think of her as in opposition to people like Clodius, Caesar, Clodia. And she's coming of age, she's coming into adulthood during that civil war between Caesar and Pompey. Her husband fought on Pompey's side. They both survive Caesar's assassination and the rise of Octavian, and then we go into civil war again. So we can assume that they are more on the side of the assassins. That is not mentioned. That is an assumption just on the basis of where they seem to be coming from. Now, we don't know much about her early life because, as you've already mentioned, the first 20 lines of the inscription are lost. Anything her husband would have written about her family, her upbringing, her origins is gone. So we kind of get introduced mid-sentence. I always think this is very sort of almost moving that she is alone in Rome in her teens. So she's unmarried. She's vulnerable. She's left alone. She's already engaged to the man we're calling Lucretius, the person giving the speech. But he's in Macedonia.
With Pompey at the time.
Yeah. Her sister and her brother-in-law, who's called Cluvius, are in North Africa. So this is during that civil war, 49 BCE, after Caesar crosses the Rubicon. So she's about to get married, but these plans are disrupted by the civil war. So you can see, I guess this is a good indication of how big events disrupt the personal plan of people's lives.
Yeah.
And at that point, it gets a lot worse because her parents are murdered in their country villa. So that's what the inscription tells us. That she, this devastating event happens, which leaves her even more alone. Turia, and we're not given any details about this in the inscription, but somehow she brings the murderers to justice. So she brings about a trial. Again, no details on how this is done, but Lucretius mentions her making insistent demands in her pursuit of justice. So presumably she brought some legal case against them and was successful.
It sounds like if it's going to that extent that they would have been, you know, known people. If her efforts are persistent, it sounds like, you know, and I'm inferring a lot here, they're hard to target people.
Maybe, I mean, it's from the very beginning of what we've got, she is depicted as somebody who is not going to take things lying down. That she is, the word persistent is a good one, that she is going to stand up for her rights. And from the very beginning, we are, I think as the audience, imagine ourselves into being the Roman audience reading this inscription, that's meant to be quite surprising to us, that a woman, especially a very young woman, unmarried, is able to take this on her own.
Yeah.
Now, if this did happen, then maybe there were other male family members helping her, but maybe not. I mean, he describes her as being entirely on her own, which would take a lot of guts. Now, the trials, the travails for Turia aren't over here, because even after she successfully brings her parents' murderers to court and has them found guilty, there's some controversy over her parents' will. There are people claiming, this is a kind of inheritance hunters they're depicted as almost, claiming to be her relatives, so acting as her, you know, tutelae, guardians, and that they should inherit the father's property. Mm. So this is kind of a legal minefield. She's very vulnerable to this as somebody without close relatives around and unmarried, so no husband to lead her through it. And the inscription says, it was your firm decision. It's all written to her, by the way, which is something we should have perhaps pointed out. So it's written in the second person to Turia, which is one way that funerary inscriptions can be written. It was your firm decision you would defend your father's written word. So again, this implies that she takes this to court and is successful, gets the claimants to back off from this. All right, so after doing all of this apparently on her own, she moves in with her future husband's mother, with her future mother-in-law in 48 BCE to protect her modesty. Now, Turia is actually in the house of Milo, and this is mentioned in the inscription that the husband had bought the house of Milo, the supporter of Pompey, who had been exiled in 52 after murdering Clodius, being responsible for that murder. And in the inscription, we hear that Milo's supporters show up and try to take the house back from the mother and Turia. And remember, the husband still isn't there. So this is another kind of traumatic event that these women go through.
Mm.
You beat them back successfully, he says in the inscription, and were able to defend our home. Again, not sure how. And then we've got 12 lines missing. So if there were more detail, it's gone. I don't think there would be more detail, though, because he is short on detail. And despite the length of this inscription, just when things get interesting, quite often we're not given the how these women managed to accomplish this.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, he does jump around a bit in terms of time periods, but we are told that after Pompey's defeat, Turia sends food, money, slaves to help him out, because of course he's on the wrong side of the argument. She sends her own jewelry for him to sell and maintain a dignified way of living during his escape.
That's a quote from the inscription.
You provided abundantly for my needs during my flight and gave me the means for a dignified manner of living when you took all the gold and jewelry from your own body and sent it, and over and over again enriched me in my absence with servants. I think that probably is enslaved people in the Latin. Money and provisions, showing great ingenuity in deceiving the guards posted by our adversaries.
So I imagine once a civil war has been lost, it's a bit difficult to get home if you are on the losing side.
Mm.
So great that she supported him. Bit strange that, you know, the support that he needed was access to the Qantas lounge, essentially. You know, he didn't want to be slumming it on the way home.
It makes me think of the scene, I don't know whether you've seen this film or read the book, Gone with the Wind, where Melanie, who's the good woman, played by Olivia de Havilland, not the bad woman, Scarlett O'Hara, who's a lot more fun, Melanie gives her wedding ring up for the cause, for her husband and the other soldiers who've gone off to the Civil War.
Yes.
Representing the South. So on the wrong side as well. That's kind of seen as the pious thing to do.
Yes.
But Melanie's kind of boring, to be honest, in that book. And I feel like, oh God. So this is Turia putting herself second. And that's what we see a lot of in this inscription. She puts herself second for the sake of the men around her, especially her husband. And that's what she's expected to do. You know, I think this is probably my first response to this when I read this years ago, is that, oh, you know, this is a happy marriage where she's in there with the causes that her husband is fighting for. You know, she's politically active. She's backing him up, supporting him. That's great. I also think we don't know what she did, what she thought. Maybe she acted exactly like this and for these reasons. Maybe she didn't do half of this. Or maybe she did it and she resented it. But this is her husband's representation of her piety. That's all we know.
Yes.
Now, there is a degree to which this is a bit of an old-fashioned idea by this time. The idea of the happy marriage, the marriage where the wife and husband do fit together well and support each other, is always an ideal in Rome. But that idea that that is her first point of loyalty goes back to something called the Manus marriage, which is a more mid-republican form of marriage where literally it's as if the husband adopts the wife. So she comes into his family and is under his control, basically, entirely, his potestas, his power. Whereas by this period, we know that a lot more marriages were non-manus, which meant that literally she stayed under the power of her father, her natal family.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily better for the woman. And a lot of this is to do with property rights and that kind of thing. And, you know, it gets borne out, I guess, in a hideous way in the Augustan marriage laws, which are coming up in the not too distant future, which assert that a woman taken in adultery in certain circumstances can be killed by her father.
Mm.
All right. So it's still the father who has the power there, that she never actually leaves the father's family when she marries, that she can always be brought back into that. But the more old-fashioned way was this kind of transfer over to the husband's power. And that seems to be what's reflected in this as an ideal in this marriage, even though it's represented as a very cooperative and, you know, they kind of have ideals on the same plane kind of marriage.
Yeah.
Her loyalty is to him. That would make them seem a bit old-fashioned by this period.
Yes.
And that fits with them being on the optimate side, the more senatorial, the more traditional side in the civil wars.
Mm. Where we narratively run into at this point is the experience of the proscriptions during the Second Triumvirate that are brought up by Octavian and Mark Antony. Lucretius, quotation fingers, comes back to Rome. Welcomed slash reintegrated slash accepted, forgiven back into Roman society, grudgingly deals with it, I guess. Gets married.
Yep, yep, that's important. Yeah. They finally get to get married.
Yeah, there's going to be a wedding or a hanging.
What a lovely thought. This part of the inscription is lost. So that stage of the early years of Octavian being in charge, mm-hmm. the Second Triumvirate. You know, maybe Lucretius, quotation marks, was so opposed to Caesar that he was even one of the assassins.
I don't know. There was a long list of assassins
Octavian,
there.
Octavian, not very forgiving. So yeah. I'm not sure he'd have survived.
Yeah.
That theory I'm not a big fan of. And as I say, and you wouldn't put it on the inscription anyway, but there is a bit of a gap there.
Mm. So what does it tell us then about their experience during the proscriptions?
Well, it actually kind of praises Turia. He shows some modesty here. You know, there's some self-deprecation going on. He says that he's kind of hot-headed in his opposition. He's brash, but Turia keeps level-headed and keeps him hidden. All right, so she's all about protecting him. It always comes back to her care for him.
Mm.
If we believe it's Lucretius, then in Appian, he initially leaves Rome again with two slaves, but he runs out of food and he has to come back. He hides in a tomb, which is, you know, pretty extraordinary, nearly caught by people robbing the grave, and uses his one remaining enslaved person as a decoy, lovely, and makes it back to his wife, who hides him again. Hides in between the planks of a double roof until his friends got his name erased from the proscription. Now, that is if you believe that this is Lucretius and Turia, which, as I've said, a lot of more modern ancient historians do not have any time for.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that, you know, the identification is pretty much based on these events.
Mm-hmm.
And even between what Appian tells us of hiding in a tomb, being disturbed by grave robbers and all of that, none of that's in the inscription.
No.
Appian says that it's his friends that got Lucretius taken off the prescription list,
mm-hmm.
and the inscription attributes it to Turia.
To the wife, yes.
So you've got, even within that small amount of identification, so many discrepancies between the two different sources.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's nuts.
Yeah. I would note that the other author I mentioned, the one from the early imperial period, tells a version of this story and does name the wife as Turia, so that's where that name comes from.
Mm.
But that is a later source. And it is very moralizing kind of text, which doesn't mean that there's no information we can glean from it, but it does have a particular take on things. Anyway, one way or another, the author here is removed from the proscription lists, which is a big deal because, remember, proscription, we've kind of glossed over what it is, but it means anybody will not be taken to court if they kill you and get a portion of your property for that.
And I should say at this point that if you want to listen to the Emperors of Rome episode on proscriptions, that's back in 21st of July 2022, recorded with friend of the podcast Zachary Hirst, in which we did talk about Turia and this inscription briefly, not to this much detail. Please continue. So what, according to the inscription, does Turia do?
Turia comes with a letter from Octavian, but the only of the triumvirs in Rome is the one no one can remember, Lepidus. All right, so this is one of the few times we end up talking about Lepidus because we just mostly concentrate on Octavian and Mark Antony. And we're told Lepidus does not act well. He doesn't show himself at his best. Marcus Lepidus, who was present, was confronted with your request concerning my recall, and you lay prostrate at his feet, really abasing yourself. You were not only not raised up, but were dragged away and carried off brutally like a slave. But although your body was full of bruises, your spirit was unbroken, and you kept reminding him of Caesar, that's Octavian, Caesar's edict with its expression of pleasure at my reinstatement. And although you had to listen to insulting words and suffer cruel wounds, you pronounced the words of the edict in a loud voice, so that it should be known who was the cause of my deadly perils. This matter was soon to prove harmful for him.
That's probably overselling it.
But yeah, it's quite a bit later.
It sounds like a public display.
Yes.
And it sounds like she was treated quite brutally,
yeah,
which would have been scandalous to do to a woman of that rank.
Yeah. So there's real violence here with the talk of bruises. There's abasement, yeah, bad treatment of anybody who's a Roman citizen, but especially apparently elite woman. And also the fact that she keeps shouting the words of the edict. She's doing public speech. Again, not something you normally expect of a woman. And this is presented as entirely positive. There's a lot written on this kind of the way women are presented as, you know, being bad if they interfere in public. So if you think of characters we've covered in the past, like Clodia, even Livia manipulating from behind the scenes. But there is another kind of face of this whereby if people like Turia doing this on behalf of a man, their husband, their father, their child, whoever it is, that public speech suddenly becomes a positive.
Yes.
But certainly her husband does. That it's done on his behalf because he can't be there to do it. Right? If he were there, then she wouldn't need to, I think, is the idea. Yes. But it is very much a public display, yes. And it reflects badly on Lepidus, especially as Octavian. And of course, it helps that this inscription is being written after Octavian has become Augustus and has won out in all of this. As we get so often with talk of the proscriptions, it means that he is not to blame for anything. He's been entirely positive in this, but he just didn't happen to be in Rome. Mm-hmm. And it was all Lepidus's fault that she was treated like this. So he's absolved of responsibility yet again. And that's pretty convenient, given that Augustus is now in power and you want to keep absolutely on his good side.
Regardless, it's showing her in quite a heroic light, really.
Absolutely, yeah.
This is successful. He comes back. Mm-hmm. They settle down. Mm-hmm. The empire settles down. Mm-hmm. And they could have a life together.
Yes.
And the inscription continues.
Well, it's not all happy for them because they do not have children, right? Which is certainly, if you're a conservative Roman, the whole point of a marriage.
And an expectation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
However, the inscription tells us that Turia takes steps which are remarkable and praiseworthy, in other words, to solve this problem. We're not told the details, but, you know, it's a big deal for Romans, and it may be that she resorted to some of the cures for infertility that the elder Pliny suggests. Is this from Pliny? The use of the urine of a eunuch.
Yes, there's a plenty everywhere. Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, if we want to go to the inscription, when you despaired of your ability to bear children and grieved over my childlessness.
Her inability and his childlessness.
You became anxious lest by retaining you in marriage, I might lose all hope of having children and be distressed for that reason. So you proposed a divorce outright and offered to yield our house free to another woman's fertility. Your intention was, in fact, that you yourself, relying on our well-known conformity of sentiment, would search out and provide for me a wife that was worthy and suitable of me. And you declared that you would regard future children as joint as though your own, and that you would not effect a separation of our property, which had hitherto been held in common, but that it would be still under my control and, if I wish so, under your administration. Nothing would be kept apart from you, nothing separate, and you would thereafter take upon yourself the duties and loyalty of a sister and a mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And this is property.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is all about property.
He's saying all of this like her offer of sacrifice, of stepping mm-hmm. back, is just totally an admirable,
yeah,
horrible idea.
It's horrible to us.
It's horrible to us. But
because
this,
of the emotion involved.
For this, it's inscription worthy. It's 2 meter tall, inscription yeah. worthy on marble. You know?
But remember, it's her offer and he rejects it. So yes. This, in a way, is both praise of her. I mean, we think you. He must have thought, presumably he's right, at least for some readers, that the contemporary reader thinks that this is honourable, admirable, but of course also admirable of him that he rejects it.
So horrified was I by what you tried to do that I found it difficult to retrieve my composure. Mm-hmm. That's what he's written as his reaction to this.
So he is emotionally invested in this marriage is what he tells us. And he loves her so much that he'll keep her even though she's not providing him with children because they have no conception left. The man might be the problem with fertility.
He goes on for 10 lines about what he's thinking about this.
Do you want to read some more?
To think that separation should be considered between us before fate had so ordained. To think that you would have been able to conceive in your mind the idea that you might cease to be my wife while I was still alive, although you had been utterly faithful to me while I was exiled and practically dead! Exclamation mark. Did they have exclamation marks in the inscriptions?
No, okay, they had no punctuation.
That's a translation.
Yeah. You know what? And I hadn't picked up on that. That equivalence of exile and death is also interesting and very common. Mm. We talked about him not being rhetorically sophisticated, but it's something Cicero talks about too. So yes, she has supported him in this virtual death. He's not going to abandon her. And I think it's really interesting that according to him, her offer, she would still be involved, but she'll be a different kind of woman in the household. She'll be a sister or a mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
She'll perform a different feminine role.
She'll find my new wife.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Odd for us, not so odd for the Romans. What I find odd about this is in this situation, especially if you're an elite Roman, adoption. So common. Mm. So common to adopt children.
Yep.
Even from households where...
Where's a piso when you want one?
Yeah, exactly. They're doing it all the time, aren't they? All the time just adding random men into their family. Not even where the natal family is in dire economic need. It's just a way of joining families together. So all kinds of scenarios where you might adopt.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't come up here at all. And I wonder whether there is some extremely conservative line that it needs to be a biological child, but the Romans really didn't seem to look down on this, even in the mid-Republican period, the idea of adoption. So anyway, he doesn't talk about it if it has happened. He does talk about how they remain married for 41 years and that he desperately wishes that he is the one who had died and hadn't been left on his own.
He does go on a bit towards the end. This could have been a single tablet inscription.
Do you want to read out the bit where he goes on a bit? I think you've edited it, but you've got a quote here. It's got dot, 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 and I don't think that's fragmentary bits. I think you've edited bits out.
You deserved everything, but that it did not fall to my lot to give you everything as I ought would that. I had died leaving you still alive. You have bequeathed me sorrow and left me a miserable man. I am tormented by two emotions, grief and fear. And I do not stand firm against either. Yeah.
Despite the fact that I've deconstructed and critiqued this inscription and said, oh, you know, this is his point of view. And yes, isn't it wonderful that he has a wife who'll sacrifice everything for him? I think that his expression of fear at the end is interesting, that she has stood up for him so much, even though he's in a much more settled political scenario now and, you know, seems to be on the right side of Octavian / Augustus. He's afraid without her. That does strike me as potentially real emotion there. You know, this is a long marriage by anyone's standards.
And look, you know, I take this as a very emotional inscription. I'm still standing by that. And this is somebody who is maybe a bit too dependent on being looked after.
It's hard to be hard-hearted at the end of this inscription, yes. I think. Despite the fact that we've had the U factor in there, that I don't believe all of the elements of this.
There's been an U factor, a what factor, a ugh factor, a really as well, and that level, and an ah.
Yeah.
It's very interesting from all that perspective, plus what this tells us about what's happening to the little people, and I'm going to quotation finger that during prescriptions, not from a historian, not from the official records, and also the potential life of a woman during this period and how it directly impacts her. Everything from I'm alone in Rome as a teenager, unmarried, to my parents being killed, to having to stand up for and advocate for my husband, and et cetera, et cetera. Good, supportive, inscription worthy.
Yep. And look, it does chime in some ways with other information we have, say, on exile. I mentioned Cicero, but Ovid as well. Both of them write back to their wives asking for support, you know, that be that material or emotional. We can also think of a parallel marriage which doesn't produce children, that of Octavian Augustus with Livia. Now, granted, both of them did already have children, although Augustus didn't have a son. He manages that by many, many adoptions.
Yeah.
That's another marriage where we think that it was affection that kept them together. A bit like Turia, her ability to be adept at advising, there is a political support, very different kind of scenario, but some parallels in terms of the marriage. Look, this is a really interesting inscription in terms of putting a woman out there in public, because if these are very traditional Republican types, then it was not normal for a woman's name to be broadcast as something that you'd want to happen, certainly back in the mid-Republic. This happened in extraordinary circumstances. Now, this is a really turbulent time, so these are extraordinary circumstances. I think that's how the husband kind of manages this cognitive dissonance if that's happening for him. So, you know, we get loads of inscriptions for women that are much briefer, that just say the typical thing. Very, very common to talk about a woman as a wool worker. She worked wool. We get that here with Turia too. Lanam facit. I mean, that is literally one woman's inscription that we have. She looked after the house, she made wool. It's four words in Latin. So Turia's got that, but she's also got, it's very paradoxical. It gives great attention to her public deeds when normally you'd expect domestic virtues to be broadcast. So, you know, modesty, pudicitia in Latin, obsequium, obedience. They're there, the making the wool. That's what normally gets celebrated. She's got that, but she's also got public actions that get celebrated much more for men, the political and even, you know, she's not directly involved in military activity, but she is physically abused for the sake of her husband. So, you know, she's got that. She's got virtus. She's got courage. She's got strength. She's got self-control even more than her husband, he mentions at one point. I wanted to be brash and you were the one who kind of kept a lid on what I would say and what I would do in this very dangerous time of the proscriptions. She's not depicted as a woman with natural weakness, which is how the Romans generally saw women. She protects her husband. She makes the public and direct appeal to politicians. You know, it could be depicted in a way that means she is seen as a Clodia type or a Fulvia type. Think about Fulvia goes out there to try and help Mark Antony. Our sources depict her as an entirely negative force, as somebody who's going beyond what you should as a woman. She's too manly. Did she actually go to a battlefield even, potentially? Oh, my God, what a strange extreme version of a woman, not really a woman if she does this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the Turia inscription manages to couch this in such a way that it is entirely positive.
Yeah, you've got to imagine if Mark Antony was fond of Fulvia and she died and he put an inscription up, would it talk about those actions? You bought me supplies across the battlefield with great hardship, etc.
Mm. However much emotion and affection there is involved here, there is a rhetorical game being played.
Mm.
Right, for Mark Antony, it wouldn't have been advisable at that point to do that for Fulvia. I mean, we don't have her inscription. But for this man, at this point in time, he can frame it in such a way that these extraordinary actions for a woman become a positive. So there's plenty to see as positives in this inscription. The fact that we know so much about a woman. We get this so rarely about somebody who isn't married to an emperor. But there's also a lot of questions I have about how much we should take this at face value.
That was Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any readily available podcatching platform. You can follow Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can also find myself and Rhiannon on Blue Sky. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This podcast has been recorded and produced at the Bundoora campus of La Trobe University on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.